Earl Boone walked along the doorless stalls, stopping at the very last one in the row. Sandra Wilson stood there, the flame from a single candle throwing light upon her face. Her white blouse was filthy, and dirt streaked her cheeks.
"Hey, honey girl."
"Earl?"
He stepped in close and looked into her eyes. One was brown and one was green.
"What happened to your eyes, young lady?"
"I lost the contact, I guess."
She tried to curl her lips seductively.
"You got something for me, Earl?"
"I got it. But not here. I'm taking you out of this place."
"Where we going?"
"You come and live with me for a while. You're gonna have a shower and new clothes and clean sheets to sleep on every night."
"What about the other thing?"
"You gonna have plenty of that too."
Sandra turned to the wall and untaped the magazine photo of the model. She folded it and picked up the paperweight off the toilet paper dispenser and looked around for her other possessions. She picked up a wet, half-used book of matches from the tiles and realized that there was nothing else.
"Come on, baby doll. Ray's waiting on us out in the hall."
"Can I get a little something for my friend Tonio before we go?"
"Forget about him. We want to get out quick and quiet. I understand some of the other fellas in here might have fallen in love with you. We wouldn't want them getting jealous."
"Love?"
She rubbed her nose and laughed. They took her down the stairs and went through a large hole in the brick wall. From deep in the darkness of the side room, Tonio Morris watched Sandra leave with the old white man and his son. He wondered why Sandra would go without saying goodbye. He was sad for a moment, then felt a shudder of panic, realizing that maybe his source was gone for good. In the street, the cop behind the wheel of the idling cruiser watched the Boones emerge from the junkyard with the pretty junkie from the second floor. The three of them were headed for the garage where the others were holding their car. The cop snapped the cigar that he was holding between his fingers and tossed it to the floor.
"Shamba Mitchell," said Strange. "That's a beautiful fighter right there."
"Look at that left," said Quinn.
"I had a left like that when I never throw a right."
Strange and Quinn sat in the bleachers of the Washington Convention Center, drinking a couple of $4 drafts. In the crowd of 4,000, Quinn was among a small number of whites. The others, being the parents of a light heavyweight Texan, four frightened-looking fraternity boys, and several white women accompanied by black men. The white, light heavyweight Texan, who fought under the name of Joe Bill Rocky Jakes, was walking along the edges of the stands, having changed into street clothes after his disastrous defeat. His face was marked and puffy, and one eye was swollen shut.
"Hey, Rocky!"
shouted a guy from the stands.
"You ever notice," said Strange, "how many white fighters call themselves Rocky?"
"I think there's been one or two."
"There's that hook again,"
said Strange, pointing to the ring. Tacoma Parks's Shamba Mitchell was defending his WBA super lightweight title against Pedro Saez out of Brooklyn. Saez, a late replacement for a scratch William Joppy, had not been expected to show too much, but he was proving himself tonight. The fourth round ended. As the fighters went to their corners, a blonde, showing a whole lot of leg, climbed into the ring and walked around the edge of the ropes, a round card held up in her hands.
"You see the ladies?"
"I like round two myself," said Quinn.
"I'm not talking about the ring girls, Terry. I'm talking about our ladies, our dates."
"They went to get a couple of beers 15 minutes ago."
"They're okay. Probably down there with their faces together, having the firelight. Talking about us."
"I hope they are. It's when they stop talking about us, then we're in trouble."
Strange sipped his beer and looked at Quinn out of the corner of his eyes.
"You didn't tell me about Juana, man."
"That she was fine?"
"That she was a sister."
"She's half Puerto Rican."
"Half nothing. You got a drop of black in you, you are black."
"Got a problem with it?"
I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It took me back at first because I didn't expect it."
"It's the way we're programmed. It's all it is."
"Now you're going to tell me what it is? Because you didn't notice, you've been getting a lot of looks here tonight."
"She's been drawing the looks, and I don't blame the guys who've been looking."
"You're going to have to at least face this, Terry. There's a whole lot of people, black and white. They just don't believe in mixing, man. That doesn't make them racist or anything like that. It's just their opinion, straight up.
As long as they stay out of my business, they can have any kind of opinion they want."
"I got to admit it.
When we came up on the two of you, first thing I thought was, Terry got himself a one-time date with a black woman for my benefit. Trying to make an impression on old Strange. Like here I am, Terry Quinn, loving all the people. Can't you see I just want us all to get along? Quinn laughed.
I'm through trying to impress you, Derek. You ought to know that by now. I told you everything I know. I mean, can we just hang out and not deal with it for one night?
So, how long you been seeing her?
Not too long, I guess.
I'm crazy about it, too. You want to know the truth?
I got eyes. How about you and Janine?
Shoot. We've been seeing each other now, I don't know, about 10 years. Not exclusive, nothing like that.
She's in love with you.
Go ahead, man.
Look, I got eyes, too.
My mother always tells me that old parable about a guy went all around the world looking for diamonds when all the time he never did think to look in his own backyard.
Diamonds in your backyard.
I've heard that one plenty of times. Yeah, she didn't make it up. But when it's your mom telling you, you tend to listen. Anyhow, I guess me and Janine, we're good for each other in a lot of ways. Strange knew it was deeper than that between him and Janine, but he was a private man, and that was all he could bring himself to say. Sayers issued a flagrant blow to Mitchell, sending him to his knees. The increasingly raucous crowd booed loudly as the ref directed Sayers to his corner and deducted a point. At Mitchell's nod, the ref restarted the fight. Mitchell came out with a fury, throwing a flurry of punches and a blur of speed and power.
You're gonna see something now, said Quinn.
Yeah, Shamba's gonna fuck him up.
Mitchell decisioned Sayers unanimously. Janine and Juana walked up the stands carrying two beers each.
Damn, we all been,
said Strange as they took their seats. He sounded mildly cross, but it was plain from the relieved look on his face that he had been worried about Janine.
Juana wanted to see Sugar Ray, said Janine.
He's down at ringside.
You see him?
Mm-hmm,
said Juana, and she and Janine laughed.
Saw Don King, too.
Must have made you hungry for some cotton candy, said Strange.
Wondered why my stomach was growling, looking at that hair of his.
How you doing? Said Quinn, touching Juana's hand. Janine's really nice, she whispered.
Having fun?
Uh-huh.
He kissed her lips. A tuxedoed man came into the ring, pulled down the hanging microphone, and began to describe, with flourish, the participants in the main event.
Who's that guy? Said Quinn.
Discombobulating Jones, best ring announcer in D.C.
Here we go. Bernard Hopkins.
Hopkins took out Simon Brown, said Strange. You know that?
The main event had Hopkins in a rematch with Robert Allen for the IBF middleweight crown. Their first pairing in Vegas had been marred by Allen's shoves and holds and ended as a no contest when Hopkins fell through the ropes and sprained an ankle.
Allen's doing it again, said Strange well into the first round. He's headlocking a man. He doesn't want to fight.
Allen seemed to fake an injury, claiming himself the victim of a low blow. The spectators became angry, calling Allen a punk and a bitch. As they grew more boisterous, they moved en masse toward the ring. The fight continued with round after round the same. The crowd's taunts became louder and more threatening.
These people want blood, said Strange. Let's get out of here. This fight stinks anyway, and you know Hopkins is going to win.
Out in the auditorium, as they walked down the carpeted lobby, a young man in a group of three made a comment directed at Juana, saying how he'd like to kick that shit deep. Quinn felt his face grow hot and the tug of Juana's hand on his leather. He kept walking, and the movement calmed him. Once outside, they walked down 10th. Strange and Quinn followed Janine and Juana, who was stepping quickly, talking to one another up ahead. Juana and Quinn followed Strange and Janine over to Stan's, a local bar where they had a round and then another before last call. By now, they were all a little bit drunk, and Juana and Janine didn't seem to want the evening to end, so they agreed to meet up at Strange's row house for one more. Strange bought a 12-pack at the market and drove up Georgia. Janine sat beside him on the bench, her thigh touching his, while Strange messed with the stereo, popping in War Live and fast-forwarding the tape to a song he liked.
What are you looking for?
Asked Janine.
Get down. Here it is.
Strange turned the bass dial and put more bottom into the mix.
What's Ron doing on Monday, you know?
He's working a couple of jumpers, I think.
I could use his help.
We need the money he's going to bring into the business, Derek. Look, don't tell me this Wilson thing is going to result in a big payday, because I know you're not going to end up charging his mother enough. Let Ron do his thing and go on and do yours.
Yeah, you're right.
Strange turned up the volume and sang,
"The police! We're talking about the police!"
Janine laughed.
"You're in rare form tonight, honey."
"I'm having a good time, I guess." "Me too. I like Juana. That's a together young lady right there. Going to law school down at GW, you know that? Might have her talk to Lionel about it. Let him know, in a backdoor kind of way, that anybody can do anything they've set their mind to it. You know, she didn't come from any kind of privilege or nothing like that."
"What about Terry? You think he's good for her?"
"They stay together, they're going to have problems they don't even know about yet. Not to mention, all you have to do is look in his eyes and see, that's an intense young man. But I do like him."
Strange was doing something he called the chicken leg, Janine dancing beside him as Night Train blared through the living room stereo. Quinn was nearby, shouting out encouragement between hits from a can of beer. Juana sat on the couch, twisting up a number from some herb and papers she had found in her purse. Greco lay on the floor with his head between his paws, his tail slowly thumping the carpet.
"Sonny Liston used to train to that one," said Strange, as the song ended.
"Like you were doing right there?" asked Quinn.
"No, man, that was a dance we used to do. Check this out."
Strange held up a CD with a photograph of a 60s-looking white girl on its cover.
"Mr. Otis Redding. Otis Blue. Got any Motown?" "Shoot, Terry, Motown ain't nothing but soul music for white people, man."
"How do I know? I wasn't even alive when this shit was playing on the radio." "And I was still getting pressing curls," added Janine.
"Barely a child."
"I was there, and it was right."
Juana walked over with a joint in her hand.
"You guys want some of this?"
"I do,"
said Quinn.
"Been a while for me," said Strange.
"Come on," said Juana. "You all aren't going to start acting funny now, are you?" asked Janine.
"What's this you all stuff?" said Strange.
The four of them stood in the middle of the living room floor and smoked the joint. Strange took Quinn's shotgun, but Juana refused it. Janine just waved her hand and laughed. By the time the joint was a roach, they were all alternately giggling and arguing over the next piece of music to be played. Strange put Motor Booty Affair on the CD player and turned up the volume.
"The power of Parliament. Now we're gonna roll with it, y'all."
The four of them danced, tentatively at first, to the complex, dense songs. The bass line was snaky and insistent, and the melodies bubbled up in the mix. And as the rhythms insinuated themselves into their bodies, they let go and found the groove. They had broken a sweat by the fifth cut. Strange dimmed the lights and put on Al Green's The Bell album.
"Reminds me of those blue light parties we used to have," said Strange.
"That was before my time, too,"
said Janine, kissing him on the mouth. They slow dragged to the title tune. Janine had her cheek resting on Strange's chest, moving in her stocking feet. Quinn and Juana made out like high schoolers as they danced. As the cut ended, Janine checked her watch and told Strange that it was time to go.
"Lionel ought to be getting back to my house by now. I want to be there for him when he arrives."
Yeah, we need to clear out of here."
"Where's the head?"
asked Quinn.
"Up the stairs."
Quinn went up to the second floor. He saw the bathroom, an open door that led to a bedroom and sleeper porch, and two more bedrooms, one of which had been set up as an office. Quinn looked over his shoulder at the empty flight of stairs and walked into the office. The office appeared to be well used. Strange's desk was a countertop set on two columns of file cabinets. Atop the desk was a monitor, speakers, a keyboard, and a mouse pad, and scattered papers and general clutter. Quinn went around the desk. Beside the desk, Strange had mounted a wooden CD rack to the wall. In the rack were Western movie soundtracks, the Leon Dollars trilogy, Once Upon a Time in the West, The Magnificent Seven, Return of the Magnificent Seven, My Name is Nobody, Navajo Joe, The War Wagon, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, The Professionals, and others. There was no evidence in this room of the funk and soul music from the 60s and 70s that Strange loved so much. Quinn wondered if Strange was hiding this collection here, if he was embarrassed to have his taste for Western soundtracks on display for his friends. Quinn looked at the papers on the desk, stock-related documents mostly, along with report forms with the Strange Investigations logo printed across the top, a heap of matchbooks and a faded photograph of a pretty young woman. He picked the photograph up, recognizing the image as that of Chris Wilson's striking sister. Quinn remembered her from the newspaper stories and television reports that had been broadcast the day of the funeral.
"You see a toilet in here?" said Strange from the doorway.
Quinn looked up. Sorry, man. I'm naturally nosy, I guess. Strange's eyes were pink and hazy. He folded his arms and leaned on the doorframe. Why have a photo of Wilson's sister? For the simple reason that I'm beginning to think Sandra Wilson's the key to this whole thing. You talk to her? Strange shook his head. Gonna have to find her first. Her own mother doesn't know where she is. Sandra's a junkie, man. Got a deep heroin, Jones. Been away from the house a long while now. Wilson was looking to hook up with her. Maybe bring her back home is what I think. And another thing I think is, on the night he was killed, Chris got a phone call that has something to do with Sandra. Quinn dropped the photograph to the desktop. You think Ricky Kane has something to do with that? I like your instincts, Terry. Well, do you? It crossed my mind. You need to talk to Kane. If he's involved, it won't do any good to talk to him. It would shut him up for real, and I got no kind of leverage. It might even hurt my chances of finding Sandra.
That's what you're looking to do now?
Yeah. Finish what Chris Wilson started. Bring her home.
Because you know you got nothing else for Leona Wilson, right? You know there was nothing deeper than what got put on the record about my involvement in the death of her son.
You telling me?
I'm asking you, Derek.
Look here, man. Strange rubbed his cheeks and exhaled slowly. Damn, I am fucked up. I haven't smoked herb in years, you want the truth. Don't know why I did tonight, but I gotta blame it on something, I guess.
Blame what?
The crazy thing I'm getting ready to ask you to do. See, my associate, Ron, he's gonna be busy next week, and I could use your help.
Name it.
A tail and surveillance on Ricky Kane, for starters. I was thinking Monday morning.
Tell me what time.
You don't even have a car.
I plan to go out this weekend and buy one.
Just like that. Getting tired of Juana chauffeuring me around. Okay, then. I'll call you Sunday evening, let you know where we can meet.
Derek?
What?
This mean I'm off the hook?
Oh, shit. Said Strange, chuckling from deep in his gut. You're something, man.
I'm serious, Derek.
Okay. That hook you're talking about? You put yourself on it. You got to admit to yourself the reality of the situation. You got to free your own self, man.
You just said...
I said that I suspect there was something with Chris Wilson and his sister. That her lifestyle is what drove him to D Street that night. But you yourself admitted that Wilson was trying to tell you and your partner that he was a cop.
He was screaming his badge number out to you, man, but you wouldn't listen.
Look, you wouldn't listen. You saw a black man with a gun, and you saw a criminal, and you made up your mind. Yeah, there was noise and confusion and lights. I know all about that. But would you have listened to him if he had been white? Would you have pulled the trigger if Wilson had been white? I don't think so, Terry. Cut through all the extra bullshit, and you're going to have to just go ahead and admit it, man. You killed a man because he was black.
Quinn stared into Strange's eyes. Quinn wanted to say more in his defense, but the words wouldn't come. He was certain that any words he could choose would be insufficient. How could a white man ever tell a black man that he wasn't that way without sounding self-serving or duplicitous?
They heard Janine's voice calling them from the bottom of the stairs. Strange lowered his gaze to the floor. Come on, Derry, he said, his voice nearly a whisper. We better go.
Lionel Baker came home at 1:45 in the morning, nearly 2 hours past his curfew.
Janine had been waiting in the living room, parting the curtains of the front window every few minutes to check for her son, as Strange sat patiently beside her.
Alexis finally pulled up on Quintana in front of her house, and when she saw her son emerge from the car, Janine said, "Thank the Lord."
Strange knew Lionel had been smoking herb or doing something other than just drinking as soon as he walked through the front door. He didn't look his mother in the eye as he greeted them with a, "Hey," and tried to get past them and up the stairs without another word.
"Hold on a minute, Lionel," said Janine.
"What is it?"
he said, looking at her directly for the first time. He glanced at Strange, then back at his mother, and an impudent smile threatened to break on his face.
"Where you been, son?"
"Out with Ricky, just rolling, listening to music. Can't you just let me go up to my room for a change? You always be stressing and shit."
Janine rose up from her seat.
"Don't you be taking a tone with me, young man. Me and Mr. Derrick been sitting up worried that you were in some kind of trouble or worse. And now, you come walking in here looking all red-eyed. What about y'all? What? Forget it, Mama.
He turned and went up the stairs. Janine froze for a moment, then moved to follow her son. Strange took hold of her arm.
Hold up, baby. I'll talk to him, all right?
On the second floor of the house, Strange knocked on Lionel's closed door. Lionel did not respond. Strange turned the knob and walked inside the bedroom. Lionel was standing, looking through his window, which gave a view of the street.
Lionel?
What?
You know your mother loves you, right?
Sure.
When she asks you where you've been all night, it's just her way of letting off a little steam. She's been sitting down in that living room, worried sick about you for the last 2 hours, and you come through that door, she's got to give you a taste of what you've been putting her through all night.
I know it. It's just... I'm nearly a man, Mr. Derrick. I don't need all these questions all the time. See what I'm saying?
While you're living under her roof and she's paying for that roof, it's something you're just going to have to deal with.
And there goes Mama, telling me my eyes are looking red when y'all look like y'all been smoking cheever your own selves.
We drank a few bottles of beer tonight, that's all, lied Strange. I don't know, maybe we had one too many, but we did have fun. I'm not going to go and apologize for that, because your mama deserves it hard as she works. Now, I told you what I thought about you driving around in that fancy car getting high. I still think you're setting yourself up for something that could affect you your whole life.
And your life ain't even started, son. You're not my father,
said Lionel softly. And at once his eyes filled with tears.
Don't call me son.
Strange put his hand on Lionel's shoulder.
You're right.
I never did have the kind of courage it takes to be a father to a boy for real. But there's sometimes when I look at you, when you're making one of your jokes at the dining room table, or when I see you dressed up looking all handsome and ready to go out and meet a girl, I get a sense of pride. Sometimes when I look at you, Lionel, and I get the kind of feeling that I know a father must have for a son. Strange pulled Lionel to him. He felt Lionel's heart beating hard against his chest. He held Lionel for a little while and let him break away.
Mr. Derrick?
Yeah.
The way it is with you and my mother, what I'm trying to say is, I know what time it is, see? I know you're trying not to disrespect her by staying in her room while I'm here, but I was thinking, see, that you disrespect her even more in some way by not waking up in her bed.
Huh?
What I'm saying is, I'd like it if you just went ahead and stayed the night.
I'll, talk to your mother, see if that's all right.
Strange went down the hall to Janine's room. Inside, Janine was sitting on her bed, the toes of her stocking feet touching the floor. Ronald Isley was singing Voyage to Atlantis from the clock radio set on her nightstand, and she had turned the light down low.
Everything okay? Fine.
He wants me to spend the night.
Do you want to?
Yes.
You feed Greco?
I opened a can of Alpo for him before we left my house.
Come here,
said Janine. She smiled and patted the empty space beside her on the bed. On Saturday morning, Strange ate breakfast with Janine and Lionel at the 3-Star Diner on Kennedy Street in Northwest. The 3-Star was owned and operated by Billy George Lakos, the son of the original owner, Mike George Lakos. Strange's father, Darius Strange, had worked for Mike as a grill man at the diner for 25 years. Billy George Lakos and Strange were roughly the same age. On Saturdays, when Mike and Darius both had their sons with them, Billy and Strange had played together on these streets while their fathers worked. Strange had taught Billy how to box and make a tackle, and Billy had introduced young Derrick to comic books and cap pistols. Billy was Strange's weekend playmate and his first white friend. When Mike George Lakos died of a heart attack in the late 60s, Billy had dropped out of junior college and stepped in to take over the business, as there was no insurance or safety net of any kind for the family. He had not intended to stay, but he did. The neighborhood had gone through some changes, and the menu had moved closer to soul food, but Billy ran the place the same way his old man had. Breakfast and lunch only, open 7 days a week.
Pass me that hot sauce, Lionel.
Lionel slid the bottle of Texas Pete down the counter, past his mother to Strange. Strange shook some out onto his feta cheese and onion omelet, and a little into the half-smoke that lay beside it.
"Good breakfast, right?" said Strange.
"Mm-hmm," said Janine. "The breakfast is tight," said Lionel. "But they could play some better music in this place."
"Music is fine."
Billy played gospel in the diner on Sunday mornings as many of the patrons were coming straight from church. His father had done that, too. Billy George Lacos walked down the rubber mat behind the counter, carrying a pot of coffee he had drawn from the urn. Billy was big-boned, with large facial features, most predominantly his great eagle nose. With the exception of two patches of gray on either side of his dome, he had lost most of his hair.
"Want me to warm that up for you, Janine?"
said Billy, gesturing in the direction of Janine's coffee cup.
"A little bit more, thanks."
Billy poured her some coffee and filled Strange's cup to the lip without asking.
"How's your mom doing, Dick?"
Strange made a so-so flip-flop movement of his hands.
"Itsy-keetsy." "Yeah, mine too. Tough old women, though, right?"
He walked down to the grill area to talk with his longtime employee, Ella Lockhart, who had come up in the neighborhood as well.
"You speak Greek, Mr. Derek?"
"A little bit,"
said Strange mysteriously. Billy had taught him one or two useful expressions and a whole lot of curse words.
"Dag!"
"You got something planned today?" said Strange to Janine.
"What do you have in mind?"
"I want to stretch my legs. I'll be getting real busy tomorrow, and I might stay that way. It's cold, but with all this sunshine, I was thinking I'd take Greco for a walk down in Rock Creek. Maybe go by the home and visit my mother after that."
"I'm up for it."
"Lionel?"
"I got plans. That wilderness family trip sounds good and all that, but, if you don't mind, I'd just as soon spend my day looking at the women up at the mall."
Billy rang them up at the register. On the way out, Strange stopped, as he always did, at the wall in the front door where several faded photographs were framed and hung. In one, Strange's father stood tall with his chef's hat cocked rakishly, a spatula in one hand, a smile on his chiseled, handsome face. Mike Drochlacher, short and rotund, stood beside him.
"That's him right there," said Strange.
And neither Lionel nor Janine said a thing, because they knew that Strange was just having a moment to himself.
"Yazoo, Derek,"
said Billy George Lacos from behind the counter.
"Yazoo, Azili,"
said Strange, turning to wave at his friend. Strange winked at Lionel, who was obviously impressed, and they headed for the door. Quinn walked south on Georgia Avenue through Silver Spring and down over the district line sometime in the afternoon on Sunday. He passed tattoo parlors and car washes and auto dealers, African-American-owned barbershops and clothing stores, beer markets and fried chicken shacks and stores selling cell phones and pages. He walked for an hour without stopping. The day was cold, but the sun and his movement kept him warm. He stopped at a small used car lot on the west side of Georgia. Multicolored plastic propellers had been strung around the perimeter, and they spun in the wind. There was a trailer on the edge of the lot where salesmen went for the clothes, and above the trailer door, a large sign had been mounted and encircled with marquee-style lights. The sign read, "Eddie Riders, where everyone rides." Quinn walked into the lot. Quinn wasn't a car freak, but his stint as a police officer had put him in the habit of mentally recording models and model years. The trouble he'd had the last few years of his job, and the trouble he was having now standing in the lot, and looking at rows of cars was distinguishing one manufacturer from another. Most of the cars from the early 90s on looked the same. The Japanese had built the rounded prototypes, and the Americans and the Koreans and even some of the Germans had followed suit. So the back end of a late model Hyundai was, at a glance, indistinguishable from that of a Lexus or a Mercedes. A $15,000 Ford looked identical to a $40,000 Infiniti. Quinn had done without a car for so long because nothing he saw turned him on.
"How you doing today, sir?"
said a startlingly nasal voice behind Quinn. Quinn turned to find a short, thin, middle-aged black man standing before him. The man wore thick glasses with black frames and a knockoff designer sport jacket over a white shirt and balloon print tie.
"Doing fine." "Name's Tony Tibbs. They call me Mr. Tibbs." "Just kidding, Matt. Actually, they call me Tony the Pony around here, because I give good ride. You know what I'm saying? I didn't catch your name, did I?"
"It's Terry Quinn."
"Irish, right?"
"Uh-huh."
"You looking for something special today, Terry, huh?"
"I need to buy a car."
"Well, I don't think I can help you, man. Just kidding."
Quinn looked Tony Tibbs over, pathetic and heroic both at once. The privileged, who had never had to work, really work to pay their bills, could ridicule guys like Tibbs all they wanted. Quinn liked him, and he even liked his lousy jokes. But in the interest of time, he thought he needed to set him straight.
Listen, Tony, here's the program. I see something I like here, and the price seems fair. I'm not going to haggle with you over it. I'm just going to pull out my checkbook and write you a check today for the full amount. I don't want to finance anything here. I just want to pay you the cash money and drive the car off the lot.
Tibbs looked a little hurt and somewhat confused. Places like this were selling financing, not cars, and they were selling it at a rate of over 20%. The no-haggle bit seemed to knock Tibbs down a notch or two.
I understand.
Also, we go into that trailer there? I don't want to buy a service contract. You even mention it. I'm going to walk away.
Okay. Good. Now sell me a car.
Nothing stoked Quinn as they walked around the lot. Then they came to a small row of cars beside the trailer, where three old Chevys sat waxed and gleaming in the sunlight.
What are these? Eddie Rada's pets.
He loves Chevelles, man.
They for sale?
Sure. He turns them over all the time.
Tibbs saw something in Quinn's eyes. He smelled blood and straightened his posture.
That's a high-performance 67 right there. 350-12 boat.
Tibbs pointed to a red model with black stripes.
There goes a 72. Got a cowl induction hood and hooker headers, man.
What about that one? Said Quinn,
chin nodding to the last car in the row, a blue-over-black fastback beauty with Krager mags.
That's a pretty SS right there. 396, 350 horses. Four on the floor, Hurst shifter. Got those Flowmaster mufflers on it, too.
What year is that?
1969.
The year I was born.
You ain't nothing but a baby then.
Pop the hood on it, will you? Quinn got under the hood. The hoses were new and the belts were tight. You could pour a holster full of French fries into the block and eat off the engine. He pulled the dipstick and smelled its tip.
Clean, right? Said Tibbs. You don't smell nothing burning there, do you?
It's clean. Can I take it for a ride?
I got the keys inside.
How much, by the way?
I'm gonna go right to the bottom, seeing as how you don't like the haggle.
How much?
$6,500. That's Grand Theft Auto right there. Boss finds out I sold it for that, I might just have to go ahead and clean out my desk.
$6,500 is right for this car.
$65,000 is right as rain.
Quinn chuckled.
What's so funny?
Nothing.
This car rides as good as it looks. You get yourself a deal.
Quinn met Strange for breakfast on Monday morning at Sweet Daddy's All Souls Paradise House of Prayer, occupying much of M Street between 6th and 7th and Northwest. The church was a modern, well-funded facility, serving the community through religious and outreach programs, with a staff of motivated individuals who kept an eye on the grounds in what was a marginal neighborhood at best. Quinn parked his Chevelle in the church-owned, protected lot, and went to the cafeteria on the ground level of the complex. Uniformed in plainclothes police, community activists, businessmen, parishioners, and local residents ate there every morning. The portions were generous, and the prices dirt cheap.
You ready to go to work?
Said Strange, pushing his empty tray aside.
What you got lined up?
We'll hang out near Ricky Kane's house this morning. He lives with his mother out in Wheaton. If he leaves, we'll follow him, see how he fills up his day. Here.
Strange slipped a cell phone out of his jacket along with a slip of paper.
Use this. It's Rod's. My number's on there, and so is yours. You got yourself a car, right?
Quinn nodded.
Think you're gonna like it, too.
Out in the lot, Strange laughed when he saw the super sports Chevelle with the racing wheels.
Something wrong?
It is pretty.
What then?
You young bloods always got to be driving something says, look at me. Ron Lattimore's the same way.
That Caprice you got looks exactly like a police car. We got less of a chance of getting burned in mine than in yours.
Maybe you're right. Anyway, we'll take both of them, see how things shake out.
Ricky Kane's mother owned a small house, brick base with siding off Bears Mill Road on a street of houses just like it. The builder who'd done the community in the 1960s had showed little ambition and less imagination. Strange phoned Quinn, who was parked down the street at the next corner.
You still awake?
I got coffee in the thermos, said Quinn.
Bet you gotta pee, too.
Now that you mention it.
You see our boy when he came out?
I saw him.
Another little punk with a big dog.
Strange had walked his tan pit bull halfway down the block an hour earlier while Strange took photographs with his long-lensed AE-1. Kane, medium height, blonde and thin, was wearing a thermal vest under a parka, a knit wash cap, and oversized jeans worn low on his hips. He had a hint of a modified goatee on his bony face.
"He sure doesn't look like the same guy who was on the TV interviews, does he?" said Strange. "Check out that car of his, too. Kane got rid of that shitwagon Toyota."
There was a new red Prelude with shiny rims and a high spoiler sitting in the driveway of Kane's house.
"I see it. He did get a settlement."
"Yeah, that could be it."
Quinn took a sip of coffee from the thermos.
"I tell you how much we enjoyed meeting Janine the other night."
"She's cool. Hell of an office manager, too. You got yourself a fine young lady there as well."
"I know it."
"All right, here comes a boy."
Kane was coming out of the house with a gym bag in his hand. He opened the trunk of the Prelude and dropped the gym bag in, closing the lid and locking it.
"Going to work out, you think?"
"Maybe."
"I'll go first,"
said Quinn.
"Yeah. Wouldn't want him to burn me or nothing like that."
Strange and Quinn circled the block while Kane went into a 7-Eleven for coffee and smokes, then picked him up again as he headed south into D.C. He took 13th Street all the way downtown, cutting over to 14th, and pulling into Car Park Garage just past D.
"Shall I follow him into the garage?"
"Park on the street. Park illegal if you have to. I'll pay the ticket." Quinn curbed the Chevelle. Strange did the same to the Caprice, a half block south.
"What now?"
"Elevators in that garage go up into that building to the left of it. Unless he's got business in that building, and I don't think he does, he'll be coming out of those double glass doors right there in about 3 or 4 minutes.
"Why don't you think he's going up into that building?"
"Because he's going into that restaurant, the Purple Cactus, across the street."
"Want me to follow him?"
"He knows what you look like, but not since you grew that lion's head of hair you got. So go ahead. You got shades?"
"Sure."
"Well, the only kind of disguise you'll ever need without overdoing it. And when you're following a man, use the city, Terry."
"Explain."
"Keep the subject's image in your mind all the time, but indirectly. Lose yourself in the crowd."
"There he is."
"Go on."
Quinn got out of the car and loitered near the building. Kane emerged from the building's glass doors. Strange watched Quinn follow, staying back in the moderate late-morning throng moving along the sidewalk. With his shades and the hair, Quinn looked more like a rocker with shoulders than he did a cop. Kane crossed the street and entered the Purple Cactus. Strange phoned Quinn.
"Go on in. They'll be setting up for lunch. Just tell him you're thinking of bringing a date there or something and you're checking the place out. Try and see what he's doing in there."
"Don't let Kane recognize me, right?"
"Nah, funny."
Quinn came out of the Purple Cactus 5 minutes later and crossed the street. He got into the Chevelle and phoned Strange. "He was talking to a couple of the waiters and a bartender downstairs. Old home week, I guess."
"He's coming out now."
When Kane pulled the Prelude out of the garage and onto 14th Street, Strange said,
"Let's roll."
Kane parked 4 blocks north in another garage. Strange followed him on foot this time, making a bet to himself that he knew where Kane was headed. Kane walked into CDC, the fancy seafood dining room and bar at the corner of 14th and K. The restaurant was fronted in glass, so Strange didn't need to risk going inside. Kane was talking to a man behind the bar, which was elevated on a kind of platform above the rest of the dining room. Back in the car, Strange said into the phone,
"He's making the rounds."
"What is he, a food broker?"
"He's selling something, that's a bet. Usually you see a guy hanging around with restaurant employees like that, it means he's making book.
Or taking notice for someone else."
"I heard that. Here he comes, Matt. Get ready to move."
Strange pushed the N button on the cell phone. He didn't tell Quinn that CDC was the last place Sandra Wilson had worked before she disappeared. Kane drove to a Velvet Rope exclusive club over at 18th and Jefferson, where people were often refused entry for having the wrong haircut or the wrong label on their trousers. He next hit a Euro Disco on 9th, then drove to U Street and parked in front of a yuppie nightclub. The pattern was the same, 5 minutes in and out. Kane drove east on Florida Avenue. Quinn and Strange followed. Cherokee Coleman took the gold pen off his desk and tapped it on the blotter before him.
"You looking large, Adonis?"
Adonis Delgado, seated in front of the desk, glanced down at his crossed arms, defined beneath the blue of his uniform.
"I've been working on it." "Looks like you have been. Think he looks bigger, Angie?"
Big-ass Angelo stood behind Coleman, who was in his leather chair. Angelo shrugged, his face impassive behind his designer shades.
You ain't been using them steroids, have you? You know I don't use that shit.
He had shot himself up that very morning after a 2-hour session at the gym.
But you know, those drugs fuck up your privates. Make you tiny as a Chinaman and shit.
My privates are fine, said Adonis with a scary smile, his mouth a riot of widely spaced crooked teeth. Adonis Delgado was an ugly light-skinned man. His forehead was high and very wide, and he had a stove-in nose with nostrils that flared upward in a porcine manner. His eyes were dead black and Asian in shape. Big-ass Angelo said that Delgado looked like one of those mongoloid retards.
So, what do we owe this honor to today, Adonis? How many times you like to face-to-face it with us? Me and Angie, we were getting the idea you didn't like associating with us types anymore.
I came in to make sure we're clear on that boon thing. Time comes, I want to make the last run out there myself.
You and Bucky, you mean?
Sure. He gonna be down with it? He does what I tell him to.
Okay.
Coleman cocked an eyebrow.
You seem kinda tense. You're not mad at me, are you, Adonis?
Wouldn't be because I let Earl Boone take away your girlfriend, is it?
Shit.
You talking about that skis over in the yard? So you're not mad? Coleman and Delgado stared each other down for a moment. Delgado sniffed and rubbed his nose. Like I said, she's just a fiend attached to a set of lips. I let her suck my dick once or twice is all it was. I'm through with Ray and Earl. I'll just go ahead and add her to the pile. The cell phone rang on Coleman's desk. Coleman answered it, said,
okay,
and killed the connection.
What is it, Jerky?
Said Angelo.
Our little Caucasian brother is on his way in.
I'll wait right here, said Adonis. You don't mind.
You got personal business with him?
He owes me money.
Hitting him up, too.
I did plenty for that white boy, and I don't do a goddamn thing for free. Quinn and Strange followed Kane to a side street just east of Florida and North Capitol. As Strange saw the drug set up and the boys on the street, he said into the phone,
Hold up, Terry. I'm going to take off and go up ahead. Tell me until I pull over and pick me up.
Right. Kane pulled up to an open garage door and drove through it into the bay. Strange watched him, then made a right turn. Quinn followed. Strange got back on Florida and went east to the Korean food market complex, parking his car in the lot. He grabbed his AE-1, jumped out of his car, and got into Quinn's Chevelle.
Punch it!
Quinn drove quickly back to the street off Florida where all of the drug activity was in plain sight. He parked far off, 3 blocks back from the action, and let the engine idle. Up ahead, young men stood lazy as cats against brick walls, on corners, and around a decaying warehouse-like structure encircled with broken yellow police tape. Along with Japanese and German sedans and several SUVs, an NPD cruiser was curbed on the street in front of a short strip of row houses, many of their windows boarded.
You see that Crown Vic? Said Quinn.
I see it.
You need me to get closer?
Strange leaned out his open window and snapped off several photographs.
I'm all right. 500mm lens. It's like having a nice set of binos.
There's our boy.
They watched Ricky Kane come out of the garage and cross the street like he owned it. He met a couple of the young men on the corner of the strip of houses and was escorted into the row house nearest the cop car parked beside the curb.
What the fuck we got going on here?
Said Strange.
You tell me.
Ever hear of Cherokee Coleman?
Yeah, I heard of him. Like every cop and most of the citizens in D.C. What do you know about him? Rose up in the ranks down here real quick after committing a couple of brazen murders I couldn't manage to pin on him. Coleman's one of the most murderous drug dealers this town's ever seen. I read this interview the Post did with some of the kids over in Detroit Park. They talk about Coleman like he's some kind of hero. He employs most of their older brothers and cousins than McDonald's does in this city, man. Drugs don't ever touch his hands, so they can't bust him. You see those boys out there on the street? All of them got a separate function. You got the steerers, leading the customers to the pitchers, making the hand-to-hand transactions. And then there's the lookouts, the money men who handle the cash. The ones just sitting into the business? Always the youngest. They're the ones who touch the heroin and the rock and the cocaine. Quinn nodded toward the warehouse, where addicts were walking slowly in and out of large holes hammered out of brick walls. A rat scurried over a hill of dirt, unafraid of the daylight or the humans shuffling by.
"That's where they go to slam it," said Quinn.
"Uh-huh. I bet a whole lot of junkies be living in there, too."
"What about Kane?"
"Yeah. What about our boy Ricky Kane, huh? You ask me right now, I'd say he's making a pickup. I'd say he was taking orders back there from the staff of those restaurants and bars. What do you think?"
"I was thinking the same way." Kane came out of the row house. He crossed the street quickly and headed in the direction of the warehouse structure.
"Fuck he's doing now," said Strange, looking through the lens of the camera and snapping off two more shots.
Kane ducked inside one of the large holes that had been opened in the warehouse walls.
"We can't be hanging out here too long, Derek."
"I know it.
One of Coleman's boys is going to burn us soon for sure. And that cop, wherever he is, he's got to be getting back to his car.
Let's take off. We got enough for today.
Get me to within a block of that cruiser's, man. Then book right." Quinn pushed the Hurst shifter into first gear, worked the clutch, and caught rubber coming off the curb. He slammed the shifter into second. A couple of the boys on the corner turned their heads, and one of them began to yell in the direction of the car. Strange got himself halfway out the window and sat on the lip, his elbows on the roof of the car. He took several photographs of the police cruiser, shooting over the roof, and got back into the car just as Quinn cut a sharp right at the next side street.
"Damn, Terry, I tell you to make all that noise?"
"I'm not used to the car yet."
"Yeah, well, we can't bring it down here again."
"Why, are we coming back?"
"I am. There's more to learn back there on that street."
Quinn woke up on Tuesday morning in the bedroom of his apartment and sat up on the edge of his mattress, which lay directly on the floor. He rubbed his temples. He had downed a couple of beers in the quarry house the night before, then walked by Rosita's, but Juana was not on shift. He went down to his apartment on Sligo Avenue, phoned her and left a message on her machine, and waited a while for her to call him back. But she did not call him back, and he left the apartment and walked down the street to the Tradesman Tavern, where he'd shot a game of pool and drank two more bottles of Budweiser, then returned to his place. Juana had not phoned. After his shower, Quinn went to the bottom drawer of his dresser and retrieved the 9mm Glock he had purchased several months earlier after a conversation with a man at the bar of a local tavern off Georgia. He took the gun apart and used his ALSA kit to clean it, then reassembled the weapon. He had no logical reason to own the Glock he knew, but he had felt naked and incomplete since he turned in his service weapon when he left the force. Cops got used to having guns, and he felt good knowing that there was one within reach now. He replaced the Glock in its case, which sat alongside a gun belt he had purchased at a supply store in Springfield, over the river. Quinn phoned Strange at the office in Gadgenine.
"He's out, Terry. Can you beep him?"
"Sure, I'll try. But he might be into something, you know, where he can't get back to me right away." Quinn heard something false and a bit of regret in Janine's voice.
"Let him know I'm looking for him, Janine. Thanks a lot."
Quinn got off the phone. Juana had been avoiding him. Now it seemed like Strange was ducking him, too. Strange stood before Janine's desk.
"Run call in?"
"He's out there working a couple of skips. They should bring some money into the till this week."
"Good. You go to the bank for me?"
"Here," said Janine, handing Strange a small envelope. "$220s, like you asked."
"Thanks. I'm going to be out all day. It's an emergency. You know how to get a hold of me. Otherwise, just take messages here and I'll check in from time to time."
"You're putting all your focus into this Wilson case."
"I'm almost there. Pick up those photographs I put in yesterday, will you? And phone Lydell Blue for me. Tell him I might be calling him for another favor."
"You keeping track of your hours, Derek? Your expenses?"
"Yeah, I'm doing all that."
Janine crossed her arms, sat back in a chair.
"I don't like lying to Terry like that."
"You're just doing what I told you to do. The next couple of days, I gotta work this thing by myself."
Strange went for the door.
"Derek?"
"Yeah."
"This weekend was nice."
"It was nice waking up next to you. I mean, good for Lionel, too. The three of us going out for breakfast on Sunday morning, it was like a family."
"All right, Janine, I'll see you later, huh?"
Out on Ninth, Strange buttoned his leather against the chill and walked towards his Caprice, passing Hawk's barbershop and Marshall's funeral parlor and the lunch counter that had the meat sign out front. He thought of Janine and what she'd said. She was right.
The weekend had been pretty nice. Knowing she was right scared him some, too. Strange decided he ought to call the woman named Helen, the one he'd met in the club over Christmas, see if she wanted to hook up for a drink. He'd been meaning to get up with her, but lately, busy as he was, the girl just had slipped his mind. Strange parked the Caprice on North Capitol near the Florida Avenue intersection and walked east. He walked for a while, and as he approached Coleman Street, he picked up a handful of dirt, rubbed it on his face, then bent over and rubbed some on his oilskin work boots. He had upcombed his hair back in the car. He wore an old corduroy jacket he kept folded in the trunk. On the street, he began to pass one of Coleman's young men. He put a kind of shuffle in his step, and he didn't look at them. He looked straight ahead. He walked over a large mound of dirt, stumbling deliberately as he came down off the other side, and he headed for a hole in the warehouse wall. He stepped through the hole. The room was large, its space broken by I-beams, birdshit, and puddled water on the concrete floor. Pigeons nested on the tops of the I-beams, and some flew overhead. He kept the dead look in his eyes, staring ahead, as he heard the flap of their wings. From the shadows of his room, Tonio Morris watched the broad-shouldered brother come into the main room of the first floor, mumbling what Tonio recognized as an early rap off a Joe Scott Heron LP he once owned and sold. The man, square in his middle age, was moving slow and had a zero kind of look on his face, like he had the sickness. And he was dirty and wearing fucked up clothes, but he wasn't who he was trying to appear to be. Tonio had lived it, and lived around it for too long. He wasn't no cop. No cop would come in this motherfucker right here alone. The man wanted something, thought Tonio. Had to want it bad to come into a place like this, too. Strange neared a young man at the bottom of the stairs who was holding an automatic pistol at his side. The young man looked him over as he passed, and Strange slowly went up the exposed steps. He mumbled the spoken verse to H2O Gate Blues under his breath. He knew the entire piece by heart, and reciting it allowed him to ramble on without having to think about what he would say, and it calmed his nerves. He was upstairs in the hall and followed the sounds of muted chatter and activity to a bathroom facility with open stalls. A man yelled something in his direction, and he kept walking, taking measured breaths beneath his mouth, steeling himself against the stench. The floor was slick with excrement and vomit. He came to the last stall, which was occupied by a man in a sweater, the cuffs of which completely covered his hands. Strange turned around and headed back the way he'd come. There was nothing here, no one to talk to or see, nothing at all. The brother was back in the main room, heading toward a hole he'd come through, pigeons fluttering above his head. Walking slow, but not as slow as before, Tonio Morris thinking he couldn't find nothing, and now he's fixing to get out quick.
"Psst," said Tonio, his face half out of the shadows of his room. "Get what you're looking for, brother?"
The man slowed his pace, but he didn't stop or turn his head.
"Got information for you, man. Come on over here and get it, brother."
Strange turned and regarded a sick little man standing in the open doorway of a black room. Strange walked toward the man, stopping beside a large puddle by an I-beam 6 feet from the doorway. Strange stared at the skinny man's face. His eyes were milky and glaucomic. Over the years, he'd seen this death mask many times on the faces of those who were ready to pass, when he visited his mother at the home.
"What do you want?" said Strange, keeping his voice low. "What I want? To get high. Higher than the motherfucker, man, but I need money for that. You got no money?"
Strange didn't answer.
"Suck your dick for $10.
Strange turned his head and looked back toward the hole in the wall.
"Hold up, man. The name is Tonio."
"I ask you your name?"
"You looking for something, right? Something or someone, ain't that right? Any fool can see you ain't one of us. You try it. But you ain't."
Strange shifted his posture. Water dripped from an opening in the ceiling and dimpled the puddle pool beside his right foot.
"White boy come in here yesterday afternoon. Don't imagine you get too many of those." "Not too many." "Skinny white boy with a knit cap, trying to be down." "I know him. I seen him, man. You got money for Tonio, man?" "This white boy. What's he doing in there? Is he slamming it upstairs?" "This white boy ain't no friend." "What then? What kind of business he got with Coleman?" "Do I look crazy to you? I ain't know a motherfucking thing about no Coleman."
Strange pulled folded 20s from his wallet. He peeled one off, crumbled it in a ball, and tossed it to the floor at Morris's feet. Morris picked the bill up quickly and jammed it in the pocket of his trousers.
What was the white boy doing in here?
Looking for a girl. A friend of mine.
Old friend of him, too.
Strange's blood ticked.
A girl?
A girl named Sandra.
This girl got a last name? Said Strange,
his voice hoarse and odd to his own ears.
She got one. I don't know it.
Is that right here?
Strange pulled the photograph of Sandra Wilson from his corduroy jacket, held it up for Morris to see. Morris nodded, his mouth twitching involuntarily.
You find her? Asked Strange.
Huh? Is she here?
Morris licked his dry lips and pointed his chin at the bankroll in Strange's hand. Strange crumbled another 20 and dropped it on the floor. Morris smiled. His teeth were black stubs, raisins stuck loosely in rotting gums.
Where is she?
Sancho's gone, man.
Where is she?
Two white men took her out of here not too long ago. Little cross-eyed motherfucking old man. I don't know them. I don't know their names. I don't know where they went.
Strange didn't speak. He balled and unballed one fist.
They're coming back.
How you know that?
Well, it gets hot in here.
The ones across the street, the ones by the stairs, they know when they be getting too hungry. They tell us when they're about to be fed. Those white men are bringing it in.
When?
Tomorrow. That's the way that's what I hear.
Strange reached into his breast pocket and withdrew one more folded 20. Morris held his hand out, but Strange did not feel it.
What do you know about the girl?
The white boy. He used to bring her with him when he made his visits. He'd take her with him to that place across the street. One day, he left her in there. She was across the street for a few weeks, coming and going in those pretty-ass cars. A month, maybe, like that. Then she made her way over here. She kept her own stall up there on the second floor.
You know what time those two white men are coming back tomorrow?
No,
said Morris, looking sadly at the 20 still in Strange's possession. Strange placed the bill in Morris's outstretched hand.
You see me around here again?
You don't know me.
Lest I tell you that you know me, understand?
Know who?
Strange nodded. Most likely he'd just given that junkie more money than he'd seen in one time in the last few years. Strange turned and shuffled off toward the hole from which he entered. There was a racing in his veins, and he could feel the beat of his own heart. It was difficult for him to move so slowly, but he managed, and soon he was out in the light. Strange woke from a nap in the early evening. His bedroom was dark, and he flickered on a light. Greco, lying on a throw rug in front of the bed, lifted his head from his paws and slowly wagged his tail.
Hungry, buddy? All right, then. Let this old man get on up out of this bed.
After Strange fed Greco, he listened to the soundtrack of A Pistol for Ringo, as he sat at his desk and went through the matchbook spilled across it. CDC, the Purple Cactus, the Jefferson Street Lounge, the Bank Vault on 9th, the Shaw Lounge on U, Kinnison's on Pennsylvania Avenue, Robert Farrelly's in Georgetown, and many others. These were Chris Wilson's matchbooks. Wilson knew. Strange reached for the phone on the desk and called the Purple Cactus. He got the information he needed and racked the receiver. Strange got into his black leather, slipped a few items into his pockets, patted Greco on the head, and left his house. This time, he drove his Cadillac downtown, parked on 14th at H, walked to the K Street intersection, and entered CDC. The dining room and the dining balcony were full, and the patrons were three deep at the elevated bar. Many were smoking cigarettes and cigars. A narrow-shouldered manager with a tiny mustache was trying to get a group of men, all of them smoking, to step closer in toward the bar. His emotional, exasperated, high-pitched voice was making the men laugh. Strange politely muscled his way into a position at the end of the stick. White people, in a setting like this one, generally let a black man do whatever he wanted to do. Strange waited for a while and finally caught the bartender's eye. The bartender was trim, clean-shaven, and of medium height. He had a false smile, and he flashed it at Strange as he leaned on the bar and placed one hand palm down on the mahogany.
What can I get you, friend?
Ricky Kane, said Strange, giving the bartender the same kind of smile.
What is
That a drink?
Strange placed his hand over the back of the bartender's hand. He ground his thumb into the nerve located in the fleshy triangle between the bartender's thumb and forefinger. The color drained from the bartender's face.
Saw you talking to Ricky Kane yesterday. I'm an investigator, friend. You want me to? I'll pull my ID and show it to you right here. Show it to your manager, too.
The bartender's Adam's apple bobbed, and he issued a short shake of his head.
I don't want you. I don't give a fuck about you, understand? What I want to know is, was Ricky Kane hooked up with Sandra Wilson?
Sandra?
Sandra Wilson. She worked here, in case you've forgotten.
I don't know. Maybe he was.
He picked her up once at closing time, when she was working here, but she didn't work here all that long. She lasted like a week.
She got fired?
She had attendance problems, said the bartender, his eyes going down to the stick.
My hand! Barkeep!
Yelled a guy wearing suspenders from the other end of the bar. Strange said, Kane and Sandra Wilson.
He met her over at Kinnison's, the seafood restaurant over near George Washington. She was working at Kinnison's before she came here. He was a waiter over there before he took a gig at the Cactus.
Strange leaned forward. You tell Kane or anyone else I came by? I'm going to send my people in here and shut this motherfucker down. Put you in the D.C. jail in one of those orange jumpsuits they got in a cell with some real men. You understand what I'm telling you? Friend?
The bartender nodded.
Strange released him. He bumped a woman as he turned and said, Excuse me. He unglued the smile that was on his face, shifting his shoulders under his leather jacket as he went out the door. Strange sat at the downstairs bar of the Purple Cactus. There were several empty tables in the dining area of the restaurant, and Strange was alone at the bar. Strange ordered a bottle of beer and drank it slowly. The brunette named Lena, the sensible girl with the intelligent eyes he'd seen on his earlier visits, was working tonight. He knew she'd be here. He'd phoned earlier to confirm it. Strange caught her eye as she dressed a cocktail with fruit and a swizzle stick down at the service end of the bar. The next time she passed behind him, he swiveled on his stool and said, Pardon me. She stopped and said,
Yes?
Your name is Lena, right?
She brushed a strand of hair off her face.
That's right.
Strange handed her a cocktail napkin with the words, $100, printed in ink across it.
I don't understand.
It's yours for real if you give me 15 minutes of your time. I'm an investigator.
He flipped open his wallet to show her his license.
Private, not police.
What's this about?
Ricky Kane.
Forget it.
I'm not looking to get you or anyone you work with in any trouble. This isn't about him or what he does here.
Lena crossed her arms and looked across the room.
Meet me at the upstairs bar, said Strange. I'm going to double your take tonight for 15 minutes of conversation, and I'll buy the drinks.
I've got to close out my last table.
Half hour.
Strange watched her drift. Prostitutes and junkies were the best informants on the street. Waitresses, bartenders, UPS drivers, and laborers were pretty good, too. They cost a little more. But whatever the cost, Strange had learned that most people, the ones who knew the value of a dollar, had a price.
How long did Ricky work here?
Not too long, said Lena. The incident with the police officer happened about a month after he came. The settlement came pretty quickly after that, and then he was gone.
Strange hit his beer, and Lena took a sip of hers. Her eyes were a pale shade of brown, her lips thick and lush. She had changed into her street clothes and combed out her shoulder-length shiny brown hair.
What'd you think when it went down? Given that you knew Kane was dealing drugs, did you have any doubts about what you had read in the papers?
Sure, it's crossed my mind.
Then I looked around her. The nearest couple was seated four stools down the bar, and the tender was working under a dim light by the register.
A few of us talked about it between ourselves.
Look, I put myself through undergrad waiting tables, and this place has financed half of my grad school tuition so far.
You got any kind of late-night bar business?
You're going to have someone on the payroll, whether you're aware of it or not, who's a drug source for the staff and the customers. A restaurant has a natural client base, and a bar is about the safest place you can cop.
How you feel about him now?
What do you mean?
Oh, Ricky is still coming in here doing business. He was in here yesterday taking orders, right?
I told you, I wasn't going to talk about my co-workers and friends.
they want to get involved with Ricky, it's their business, not mine.
You must have an opinion about what he's doing, though, right?
Lena nodded, looking at the glass of beer in her hand.
I don't like Ricky. I don't like what he does. I'm no user now, but I walked through that door when I was younger. Anyway, like I said, it's none of my business. Anything else?
One more thing. Strange slipped the photograph of Sandra Wilson from his leather. You recognize this woman? Ever see her with Kane?
No, not exactly.
What does that mean, not exactly?
Ricky liked light-skinned black women exclusively. She fits the bill. None of them had grass growing under their feet, I can tell you that. I don't recall ever seeing him with the same one twice.
Strange took a long pull off his beer. He set the bottle on the bar and slipped 5 folded 20s into Lena's palm.
I guess that's it. Thank you.
Lena got off her stool and drained her beer standing.
Nice to meet you.
And you.
Terry Quinn sat at the bar at Rosita's on Georgia Avenue in downtown Silver Spring, waiting for Juana Burkett to finish her shift. Juana had smiled at him when he came through the door, but he had lived long enough to know that it was a smile with something sad behind it, and that maybe things between them were coming to an end. As the last of the diners left the restaurant, Juana came out of the women's room, still dressed in her weight outfit, but washed and combed, with a fresh coat of lipstick on her mouth. I took the boss boy out extra to finish my side work. You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Quinn walked with Juana down Georgia to where the Chevelle sat parked under a street lamp. It shone beautifully in the light.
This is me, said Quinn.
What do you think?
For real?
Come on, let's go for a ride. Quinn headed into Rock Creek Park, driving south on the winding road that was Beach Drive, spring steam coming from the deck. The night was not so cold, and Quinn rolled his window down a quarter turn. The wind fanned her hair off her shoulders and bit pleasantly at her face.
Now I know what you like to listen to.
Speaks to the world I came up in. Anyway, you buy a new ride, you gotta christen it with The Darkness on the Edge of Town. There's no better car tape than that.
I like this car.
Juana's hands were in her lap, and she was rubbing one thumb against the knuckle of the other. Quinn reached over and separated her hands. He took hold of the one and laced his fingers through hers.
I'm going to make this easy on you, said Quinn.
Thanks. I got all this baggage, Juana. I'm aware of it. And I don't know what to do about it. If I didn't care about you, I'd say I'm going to stick around and let her work it out. Because I'd stay with you as long as you let me, you know? Juana nodded.
I thought when we met that it could work. But then, out in the world, when other guys were staring at us, making comments when we were walking down the street, I could see that you couldn't handle it. And it's not like it was going to go away. In this wonderful society we got here, no one is ever going to let us forget. I never wanted to be your black girlfriend, Terry. I only wanted to be your girlfriend. In the end, I wasn't sure what was really in your heart.
Maybe. In the beginning, you were some kind of symbol to me, a way to tell everyone that inside I was right. But I forgot about that, like 10 minutes after we were together. After that, in my heart, there was only you.
I'm young, Terry. I got my whole life to deal with the kinds of relationship problems that everyone has to face eventually. Money problems, infidelity, the death of love. But I don't want to deal with those things yet.
I'm not ready, understand?
I know it. It's all right.
Quinn turned left on Cheryl Drive and headed up the steep, serpentine hill toward 16th. He downshifted and gave the Chevy gas. Her fingers touched his face.
Don't forget me, said Quinn.
Strange drove north and parked his caddy on 9th, directly in front of his business. He turned the key in the front door, went inside, and flicked on the lights. In his office, he had a seat at his desk. Janine had picked up the packet of photographs he'd taken off Florida Avenue. He went through the pictures. Ricky Kane had come out clearly, as had the numbers on the bumper and side of the police cruiser parked out on the street. Strange reached for the phone. He called his old friend Lydell Blue and left a message on his machine. He didn't want to leave the cruiser's identifying number on Lydell's tape. He phoned Quinn, got his machine, told him they had work to do the next day, told him where and when he'd pick him up. Earl Boone zipped up his trousers and looked at the girl stretched out there on his bed. She drew the sheets up to her bird-like shoulders and gazed at him with those funny,
sexy, different-colored eyes. He didn't have no, what did you call that, delusions about her or anything like that. She was just a junkie, he knew. And if she kept up that pace of hers, she wasn't going to live too much longer. But damned if she wasn't the prettiest junkie he'd ever seen. You gonna be all right, honey girl? 'Cause me and my boy, we gotta make a trip into the city.
You'll leave me something, Earl?
Course I will. You know I wouldn't let you have any pain. Earl finished dressing. He heard that god-awful music Edna was playing in Ray's bedroom down the hall. He hated that new stuff sung by those pretty boys with the department store-bought hats and the tight jeans. Wonder why anyone would want to listen to that shit when they could be listening to Cash, Jones, Haggard, or Hank. Earl took a small wax packet of brown heroin from his coat pocket and dropped it on the dresser. Be back in a few hours. Sandra Wilson watched him leave, closing the bedroom door behind him. She tried to look at the packet on the dresser. She didn't want to do it now. She wanted it to last. But when she began to shake a little, thinking of it sitting up there all alone, she thought of her mother and her brother and began to cry. She wasn't sure why she was so sad. Everything she wanted was here, 10 feet away from where she was lying now. She wiped the tears off her face and got out of the bed. She walked naked across the room. From the bedroom window, Edna Loomis watched Ray and Earl out in the yard. Ray left, then came out of the barn with his gym bag and loaded the heroin into the space behind the bumper of the car. Edna drained a third Jack and Coke of the afternoon, watching him complete his task. She felt kind of funny, clammy-like, and her heart was racing really fast. She rattled ice in the glass and sucked out the last few drops of mash as Ray and Earl got into the Taurus and drove away. Edna got dressed, slipped the barn key into her jeans. She patted her pockets as she walked into the barn and strode briskly through the saloon area toward the back room. She had her little brass pipe in one front pocket, the key in the other. Edna used her key in the lock of the steel-fortified door, opened the door, and flicked on the lights. She closed the door behind her. She went quickly to the shelf mounted over Ray's homemade lab. She snatched a vial off the shelf and opened its lid. The vial was filled to the top with crystal rocks. Edna shoved the entire vial into the pocket of her jeans. Ray wouldn't be back for some time. She was going to mix a tall drink and take a walk out in those woods, smoke up those rocks and have a party her own self. Edna heard a door open in the front of the barn. Looking down at the floor, she saw the carpet remnant beside the weight bench, not completely covering the trap door. Edna heard bootsteps clomping on the barroom floor. She had always been a quick thinker. Her friend Joanna told her that all the time. There wasn't but one thing to do. Ray and Earl had only gotten a mile down the interstate when Ray told Earl they had to turn around and go back to the property.
I forgot something, said Ray. What, that speckled powder? It gives me an edge when I'm dealing with those rugheads. Go on back if you need it.
Ray U-turned the Taurus and headed back for the property. Earl cracked his window, then rolled it down halfway.
Weather turned yesterday.
It'll get cold again.
Days like this, them greases are gonna get right. You best put 'em in deep, first chance you get.
Ground's still too hard, Daddy.
Ray walked hard across the saloon floor. He pulled his keys off his belt loop and fitted one into the lock on the back door. The lock had already been turned. He reached for the knob. God damn, the door was already open.
Edna?
Said Ray, shaking his head, because he knew it had to be her had been back there. Somehow she'd gotten hold of his key. There wasn't anyone else stupid enough to test him like that. Ray went to the shelf and took down the spansels of crystal meth. He shoved the vial into a pocket of his jeans. He scanned the shelf. That other vial, the one held the ice, was gone. Edna was probably out in the woods, smoking it all up at once, greedy bitch that she was. He knew she hadn't driven anywhere, as the F-150 was still parked in the yard. Ray turned at the sound of the car horn. That would be his daddy just landing on it, telling him it was time to go. Ray looked around the room. Something wasn't right. Damn, there it was, too. The carpet remnant had been moved off the trap door. Must have been moved with all that activity they had back here with the Colombians, what with them all flopping around and shit. Even so, thought Ray, as he moved the carpet aside and lifted the trap door, holding his breath against a familiar smell. Didn't hurt to check. He looked down the wooden ladder that led into the tunnel. The lights were on down there. but that didn't mean nothing. They worked off the master switch. Earl landed on that horn again.
All right!
Yelled Ray, though he knew his daddy couldn't hear him. Ray closed the trap door, placed the carpet remnant over it, and dragged the weight bench over a few feet. Now the weight bench sat atop the trap door. Ray shut down the lights before he locked the door from the outside. He took no pleasure in hurting Edna, but he was sure gonna give her some when he came back home. Edna wasn't scared, not really. She sat on the cold dirt patiently, waiting to make sure Ray had gone away for good. And when she was satisfied, she kind of crawled around some until she found the ladder and climbed up to the trap door. The door wouldn't budge. Ray had put something over it. She wasn't surprised. She went back down the ladder and sat, gave herself some time to think. She'd seen enough of the tunnel when the lights had been on to know that it went straight back 50 yards or so, then went off hard to the right. It was a narrow open shaft, and she'd have to go through it like a dog on her hands and knees. But there wasn't nothing tricky about it. Edna had no doubt that Ray and Earl had rigged some kind of opening at the end of the tunnel, a way for them to escape into the woods from all those imaginary FBI and ATF boys they were always going on about. There was a smell of expired animal down here. Ray said there were snakes in this tunnel, but she wasn't afraid of no snakes either. She lost count of all the black snakes she'd killed with a hoe growing up out this way. Something had cacked down here. That was for certain. Maybe one of those barn cats that was always hanging around. Anyway, if she lost her bearings or something, crawling around down here, she could use the disposable lighter she had in her pocket. And the drugs. Edna had an awful headache. It seemed to be getting worse. She found the vial of ice and the lighter in the pipe, and she hit the lighter so that she could fill the pipe. A little pickup would motor her out of this place quick and just right. She smoked the rocks, coughing furiously on the last hit, and let the flame go out. The buzz started to build. It was a pleasant buzz at first. Then it was violent and it left her shaking. She realized that maybe she had smoked too much. The space felt very close, and for the first time she was frightened, though she wasn't sure of what. She wanted to get out. She thumbed the wheel of the lighter, looked ahead, and began to crawl. She could hear her own breath as she crawled. Her head pounded and it hurt something fierce. She crawled with sudden velocity and found good perches on the hard earth.
Shit!
She said, as her head hit a wall of dirt. I am at the end of the straight shot now, she thought, as she scrabbled, turning right and finding more space. The smell had grown awful and she gagged, but she crawled on. She gagged again at the lousy stench, heard a kind of crunching sound, struggled to draw in breath as she kept on and touched something soft, and crawled over another thing that was cold and hard. Edna raised the lighter in front of her and got flame. Two corpses covered in writhing maggots lay before her.
Oh, God, Ray, God, Ray, God!
She turned, the lighter flipping out of her hand. Edna fell forward onto her belly. She clawed at the cold earth, but she was too dizzy to move, and it seemed as if a hatchet had cleaved her skull. She vomited into the darkness of the tunnel and lowered her head to the ground, feeling the warmth of her own puke on her face. Her eyes were fixed and glassy, and her tongue slid from her open mouth.
They're coming out,
said Strange, looking through the 500mm lens of his AE-1.
They weren't in there long, said Quinn.
Dropping off the goods, I expect. Now they're going to get their money. A couple of Mayberry RFD-looking motherfuckers, too.
The short one's got high heels on. You see that?
Like I told you. It's the little one's got something to prove. Strange and Quinn sat in a rented Chevy Lumina 2 blocks west of the junkyard. They had been there for several hours, and Strange had filled Quinn in on everything he'd learned the day before. They watched Ray and Earl Boone leave the garage, cross the street, and head toward the row house where Cherokee Coleman kept his office. Ray and Earl spoke briefly to a couple of unsmiling young men, who led them up the stoop and through a door. A block ahead, a Crown Vic cruiser rounded the corner and headed east, driving slowly by the junkyard.
That our friend?
I'd bet it, said Strange, narrowing his eyes. Ain't nothing I hate worse than a sold-out cop.
What did you find out?
Just got the pictures back last night. Strange thought of the packet of photographs Janine had left on his desk, and something stirred in his head.
You gonna run the number?
Got a friend working on it now.
We better get out of here, said Quinn. He'll be turning around, I expect.
I was thinking the same thing. Those rednecks, when they leave, most likely they'll be driving out of here the same way they came. I'll go back over to North Capitol and park it there. Strange ignitioned the Chevy and said, Right.